Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, The Smashing Machine is out. Benny Safdie's new feature is here. Safdie brothers split up, right? One went and did Marty Supreme. The other did Smashing Machine with Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Mark Kerr, the UFC. He's not really a UFC legend. Boxing fighter, big guy who does a lot of fighting in this historic sports biopic from the late 90s, early 2000s. Also stars Emily Blunt. We took a look at it in theaters. A larger-than-life picture. Excited to talk about it. We're also going to take a look at Good Boy. This is that little indie film, an indie horror film from IFC and Shudder. It's all from the perspective of a dog, or kinda. It's about a dog named Indy who's got an owner who's in a haunted house, and the dog can see the creature, but the owner can't, so the dog has to try to save him. It's kind of like Courage the Cowardly Dog. It's got something going on. There's a little bit of magic happening here, especially if you're a dog lover. Stick around for the review. We're going to take a look at some upcoming trailers. We've got a new trailer for The Carpenter's Son, Pillion, Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro's new feature. I know that got a screening already. Results seem mixed about that, but I'm looking forward to talking about it regardless because I want to see it despite what anybody else thinks. Before we get to all of it, speaking of those Safdie brothers, we're going to talk about the hottest news story of the week from The Hollywood Reporter. Today, Timothée Chalamet's Marty Supreme has been premiered at New York Film Festival. Surprise film premiere last night to close out the festival. Josh Safdie showed up. Timothée Chalamet came out on stage. They talked about how excited they were to show it to people. We've got some rave reviews about this thing. Andy and I haven't seen it, but a lot of people have. They say it's pretty hot. What do you know about this, Andy?
So the New York Film Festival is underway. A lot of world premieres happening. We're in the midst of festival season, and Timothée Chalamet's Marty Supreme finally premiered to rousing applause. We learned a little bit more about the film. It's 3 hours long. Apparently, Chalamet has been preparing it for years. He recently said in an interview how he had a ping pong table everywhere that he was when he was shooting for Dune, when he was shooting for the Bob Dylan biopic, everything. He's been playing ping pong for years for this role. So it's exciting. It looks like he's going to be probably get an Oscar nomination, and if he does, it might be him and Leonardo DiCaprio in the best Oscar best actor race. Would be really exciting. You're going to have the legend generation and the young generation kind of come head to head. So this is exciting. This comes out of course on Christmas.
Yeah, I love some of these reviews we've got on Twitter from folks who saw it. Major exhilarating filmmaking from Josh Safdie. David Ehrlich called it one paddle after another, which was really funny. He said he can't believe we got two American movies this good back to back. People saying Chalamet's irresistible, sprawling, an electrifying sports epic, bursting with vitality from the first frame to the last. The score is getting a lot of praise, and also Chalamet. The people are saying it's like career best work, which is nuts because he's not even in his 30s, but the kid can't miss. I like people citing like Wonka. They're like, I thought Wonka was good. A lot of people were mid on it. And it turns out like Chalamet is the best part of that movie too. You know, like he's consistently turning out great work. It's so funny to imagine him on the set of Dune, like playing Bob Dylan between like ping pong lessons, like while also getting ready to read as Paul Atreides. I don't know what he's working on now, but either way, like people seem really fired up about this one. But you mentioned right before we started recording that a lot of people were fired up about The Smashing Machine too, and that didn't do all that good this weekend at the box office. So what do you think this is? This just hype, or is there maybe more to it?
You have to take festival buzz with a grain of salt because it's really impossible to tell. Every film gets major buzz. Everything is the best thing since sliced bread to come to cinema. And you really can't tell the things that are really that great and the things that, you know, people are just trying to hype up to get for awards or get sold. But you don't really know until the movie's actually out and normal, regular people, film goers can see it and give honest reviews. Because like I said, The Smashing Machine had a lot of buzz coming out of the festival. It premiered at Venice. Josh Safdie won the Silver Lion Award for Best Director.
15-minute standing ovation that movie got at Venice. 15-minute standing ovation.
15-minute, and then it's had a bit of mixed reviews, and we'll get into it more later. But like you have to take the festival buzz with a grain of salt. Now this, because of who's involved, because it's Chalamet, because it's a Christmas release, which is a big movie going day. I want to say it's got to be maybe a little bit better. Maybe it's going to live up to the hype, but you still got to kind of go in, take it all with a grain of salt because you never know until the movie's actually out.
Yeah, it's $70 million budget. It's the biggest film A24 has ever done, as far as we know, which is funny because this is Josh Safdie's first movie on his own. His brother Benny, who made Smashing Machine, just came out, got $50 million to make that movie, which we're going to talk about, by the way, the budget of Smashing Machine, because after having seen the movie, I think Andy and I both have some hot takes on how they spent that money, but... regardless, yeah, Marty Supreme seems really exciting. It's coming out Christmas Day. We will almost certainly cover it on the show, though, like it typically goes around holidays. We're probably not putting out like a Christmas Day episode or anything, but you know, we'll get around to it. This one's going to be a banger. I'm really looking forward to it. We can talk about Fast and Furious. The Fast and Furious franchise. Oh boy. Yeah, this is a story out early this week from the Wall Street Journal. Universal does not want to spend like $300 million to make the last Fast and Furious movie. And I can't blame them. What do you know about this, Andy?
So as we've said before, this franchise is in real trouble, and Vin Diesel is trying to like force it to get made and tried to drum up like audience interest and hype. And he was like, we got a release day. The studio is going to agree to this. And like, all that is false. Like, the studio has not agreed to anything. They have not greenlit anything. They have not approved a budget, a story, cast. And so this article comes out, and they're willing to do it with a big budget reductions. Basically, the previous movie cost $350 million, and it made $700 odd million, but that's not enough really for it to be profitable. It really needs to be over $1 billion at that kind of price tag. So Universal wants to cut at least $150 million from the budget, get it down to $200 million, which also means cutting a lot of the stars' budget, or just cutting out parts entirely, or just lowering salaries. And this is a big difference from Fast 7, which was the most successful of these films. And they're just, it's over, man. It's so over. And if they do finally finish this, because the previous film ends on a cliffhanger, it's going to be on a much slower budget. It's going to be much smaller. And what's really interesting about this is that they're actually looking to maybe pivot to TV, to prestige TV, and kind of create a new era of Fast and Furious.
Yeah, I think television might be a fine pivot. Considering we're streaming, is why not? Yeah, it's so funny. Like, when Diesel came out and announced it, the auto racing festival Fuel Fest this last summer, when he came out on stage wearing a t-shirt that said Toretto's Garage, and he said that he had just met with executives at Universal Pictures who said that they're going to put out a movie by April 2027. Like, it just seemed like such lofty promises for those of us that watch this space a lot. He said under three conditions they're going to get this movie. One, it's got to come back to Los Angeles. All right. Number two, it's going to delve back into street racing culture. And three, it's going to reunite Toretto with his former partner, who was played by the late Paul Walker. Two of those actually make sense for the budget. All right, so Fast and Furious becoming a globe-trotting spy franchise is nuts. It was never designed to be that, and it's funny that they pivoted there after Fast 7 had this insane success and we've made over $1 billion. Like, that was like the defibrillator the franchise needed that like restarted the heart and got everybody back into it, right? I get it. I get why it went that way, but like, trying to work a CGI Paul Walker back into the movie ain't cheap. It doesn't matter how you spin it, right? Like, it's either cheap or it's disrespectful. Maybe both, right? And not to mention, yeah, the rest of the cast probably wants to stick around. These movies are all about family. It's about bringing people in from everywhere. God, the last one ended with a tease to have Dwayne Johnson in it again. Like, how are you going to afford him? Like, Smashing Machine could barely afford him, right? And that was a smaller franchise. It just seems like such lofty promises that they can't possibly hit. There's no way that they're going to be able to get this thing turned out the way they want. So you cut the budget back, and you go back to LA, and you make it more about street racing. I do think that's wise. I don't know how you spend the rest of it, though, especially after the promises made after Fast X, which is like, dude, they had so many cliffhangers in that movie. It's hilarious how many cliffhangers they had, actually. It was such a mess.
Well, not only that, it's a big globe-trotting story spy agency. So I was like, how do you go from this bit from that back to street racing? It's a big step back. Like, the cat's already out of the bag. They've already gone to space, which they've kind of apologized for. And I don't think they should, because I like that they went to space. I was like, if you're going to be ridiculous, be ridiculous. You know, just go ahead and own it. I think the other thing that I've been thinking about with this article is we're witnessing the end of the franchise, or kind of the limits of it. And we're seeing this in the Fast and the Furious and Marvel and Star Wars. And it looks like, you know, you got maybe 15 to 20 years or something. I mean, this has been going on for almost 25 years. And it's kind of over. And, you know, Gen Z isn't into this. This is like, this is your grandpa's IP or your uncle's IP. It's just kind of too far. And franchises looks like they can maybe have expiration dates. Star Wars is doing a little bit better at almost 50 years, but they're struggling too. So it's really interesting to see what how long these things can go. Because in the 2010s, you would have thought that we would have been seeing Fast and Furious movies for the next 20 years and you know, next 100 years. Like, it's really insane, but it's really crazy to see the end of it and just see trends completely change, audiences' tastes change. They're forgetting the kids don't care about the cars. And also, a friend of ours said that, well, that kind of street racing, that kind of Japanese, like, making the souping up those kind of cars, that's kind of, it was a thing from the early 2000s, and people don't really do that anymore. So it's like, what would you even go back to? Like, street racing itself is not really a thing, allegedly.
Yeah. I think the answer is, as always, time travel. It's the only thing that can fix this, right? We always joked about the series doing time travel, but imagine them, like, legitimately embracing it as some kind of means to get back to something simpler. Like, maybe Dom Toretto just leaves it all behind and goes back 20 years and kills his old self, and there you go. It's the plot of Peacemaker season 2. And ultimately, like, Universal doesn't have any good reason to make this either. Like, that's the other thing. On the business side, they have so many good movies coming out right now. Like, unless you're trying to fell Warner Brothers or Disney, which they're not really, like, they're fine. They do not need this. You got Chris Nolan in the tent. You got new new Jordan Peele. He's going to have a movie coming out in the next year or two. Daniels is working on a new project with them. Like, they have been locking up stars. The Odyssey, right, is a Universal picture. Like, they do not need the money. Nobody is knocking down their door begging to make Fast 11 except Vin Diesel. Like, he seems to be the only person who really wants it. And that's mostly because the money he gets for each one of these films is in the realm of like $20 million. And he doesn't have a whole lot else going on. So my man needs a check. He's got bills he's got to get paid. And hey, I get it. People want to see the end of the franchise. But I don't know if they want to see it like this. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if they want to see it dragged over the finish line, which is where it seems like it might be. Cut the budget. Simple it out. Then apologize for saying Paul was going to be in it. That's dumb. And I think maybe you got a movie, right? Like, I think that's probably the direction you need to go in.
And it's almost easier just to not do that. Like, there's so many caveats you would have to make. And also, there's something like The Rock has lost a ton of weight, which we're going to talk about a little bit. He's lost like 60 pounds. He's not like the huge, big, buff dude he was at the end of that first movie. So, like, you're going to have to explain this massive physique change in one of your stars. So it's just easier to not, and it's easier to spend that money elsewhere on new things or, you know, new young talent or existing talent that's bankable, like Chris Nolan. And it was like, why would you give Vin Diesel $200 million when you could give it to Chris Nolan?
The Rock, yeah, and The Rock isn't the only star of the Fast franchise that's undergone a massive physical change, if you know what I mean. But we should move on to Heat 2. We got to talk about this. Michael Mann is trying to get Heat 2 made, which seems kind of bogus, if not for the fact that not only does it continue to be moving forward, it seems like people are going to actually make this follow-up to the 1995 feature. But the star power attached to this thing is insane. This might be like the thriller of the decade or something whenever it finally comes out. This is a story out of the Hollywood Reporter talking about the project moving from Warner Brothers to Amazon, MGM, and United Artists. We've got Jerry Bruckheimer attached to produce this thing. Scott Stuber, who's doing a lot of work over at Netflix, United Artists, he wants to produce it. So you got some money, but man, the talent around this thing is really exciting. What do you know about Heat 2, Andy?
Well, we know that it's based on a novel, continuing the story by the original author. It's not just some Hollywood thing. So that gives you at least a little bit more confidence in the story. But we're potentially have some big names attached. Leonardo DiCaprio, Austin Butler, Adam Driver, Bradley Cooper, possibly. And they're playing new characters or continuations of characters from the first movie. I wonder if Pacino comes back. He's unstoppable in that. And Heat is such a seminal work of cinema, like all of it—the cops and robbers story, the detective versus the heist man, the shootout. I mean, it could be great. And if we get these people, these top of the line actors attached to it, could be really something special.
Yeah, the book was written in 2022, Heat 2, I mean, co-written with the author Meg Gardner, which ended up becoming a number one New York Times bestseller. I oddly enough, had not seen Heat up until just this year. Andy and I went and saw it at a theater. Really cool way to see that movie for the first time. Would recommend if you have the means, especially if Heat 2 does keep coming down the pipeline. You'll see more retro screenings, right? Big theaters will throw one on, I'm sure, at some point with a Fathom event to get ready for it. United Artists want to make sure as many people have seen it as possible. But it seems like everybody wants to work with Mann, right? Everybody wants to do a Michael Mann movie. The names attached to this are really exciting. I would love to see Adam Driver in something like this. He hasn't done anything particularly mainstream in a hot minute. He's off doing his own thing. My man's running his own race. And same goes for a lot of these. Austin Butler is really choosy about his product. Leo doing this, it sounds really exciting after one battle after another. You know, playing something maybe a little bit more straight. Somebody said a rumor about him maybe playing like the Val Kilmer character, but in the future. I don't know who's going to be what in Heat. Nothing is confirmed yet, but one thing's for sure, like this thing just seems to have a lot of smoke around the fire, you know, like big budgets they're talking about, 135 to 140 million Warners was looking at. People are talking about maybe a Heat 3 getting pushed after this, like can we kick this off and make this a franchise? Very exciting for Heat fans. I got to know, Andy, what are the odds this thing is like tonally consistent with the 95 feature? There's like no way these two movies feel like one after another. You know what I mean? It's been too long. Good God, it'll been over 30 years by the time this thing comes out.
So what's interesting is that the novel it serves as both prequel and sequel. So it follows our crew in some of their earlier heists and living the high life of that success. And then also sequel to the end of the events of the first film, where not all of the crew is surviving. Many of them are killed by the end of the first film, and so it follows our survivors, you know, not living the high life, trying to just make it. And so I think that's pretty interesting. And it's been so long; it would be nice to see. I mean, you just got to update it. You know, that first film is so LA, it's so 90s. You got these big TVs, all these helicopters, like. All of that would be so different now. And so I think enough, it's one of those things, like if you do the sequel too soon or if you wait too long, it's bad. But if you wait really long, then you can really do something different.
Yeah. I like this mention of setting. One part of the book is set in Lawless South American drug zone. And there's also an overarching bad guy, more brutal than anything seen in the first movie. A murderer named Otis Wardell. All right. Could be a Calvin Candy return for Leonardo DiCaprio, maybe. Playing big evil murderer, evil villain, which is against type for him. I don't know. I don't know what's happening with Heat 2, but keep an eye on the space because it seems like a lot of money and a lot of talent is circling around it. And if I didn't know any better, there's probably going to be a picture deal sooner rather than later. One more story this week from the box office. Taylor Swift is running the theaters again, though not with the mainstream feature I think people had maybe expected out of her with like she did with her previous concert film. This album launch party thing is different, but it still also towered over the Smashing Machine, which is really funny. What do you know about this, Andy?
Taylor Swift has proven to be a box office draw. We saw this with the Eras tour that went on to make like $230 million or so, big numbers. And it's no different for the release of her latest album, Life of a Showgirl. They're not calling it a music video or a film. They're calling it a cinematic experience, otherwise known as a 90-minute advertisement for her new album, this 89-minute film, that there were behind-the-scene things and then a music video, like premiere of her new music video at the end of it you got to see. But this opened to 33 million domestic, 46 million globally. That would be huge for just about any movie, and huge for this concert going experience as well. Not surprising. When I was leaving the Smashing Machine, there was a group of like 15 girls all bedazzled and going to the Life of a Showgirl thing. So definitely a box office draw. To round out the rest of the top five, One Battle After Another made 11 million over the weekend and crossed the 100 million mark globally. Biggest opening for PTA, big milestone there. The Smashing Machine came in at 6 million, which is way under its $50 million budget, and it opened at 3,000 theaters, opened up really wide. A lot of times a movie like this will open up very small in just like New York, LA, and then slowly grow in its footprint, but they went really big because of the budget. So that's way under a budget. The Rock says, it doesn't matter, baby. I'm just here to perform and thing. All of a sudden, he doesn't care about a box office. Gabby's Dollhouse came in at number four with $5.2 million and $32 million globally. And to round out the top five, The Conjuring Last Rites, $4 million with $458 globally. Huge, the biggest of that franchise.
I can't believe last week I didn't know what Gabby's Dollhouse was. Kristen Wiig feature, right? Kristen Wiig's in that movie. I'm sure she's finding it. Taylor beating out Smashing Machine really makes it a weekend for the girls. I love this stat here. Nearly 90% of showgirl ticket buyers are female. Smashing Machine skewed 70% plus male. So 9 out of 10 of ticket buyers were girls for Taylor, and 7 out of 10 were boys for Smashing Machine. The girls take the weekend, all right? And maybe that's the way it should be. But one thing's for sure, Smashing Machine really came in under. I can't believe I saw estimates people saying it was going to make $15 million, and it didn't even make half that, right? Like, its $6 million opening is brutal. As for The Rock, as for Dwayne Johnson commenting on it, you know, I think I want to talk about his presence in Smashing Machine here in a second, but in regards to the box office, like, I think he's clearly deciding he's taking his career in a different direction. This is most evidently, like, posed by A, his appearance in this movie, and B, losing 60 pounds immediately after it. Like, he's already filmed a couple other things. I know he did that Moana live action with Disney, so we're going to see him ripped again and big. But, like, he's changing, and he spent much of his last chunk of his later half of his career here being an absolute people pleaser, right? Like, I will be in whatever mathematically is going to make the most money. That's what I'm going to do. I want people to be excited about stuff. Like, this is the kind of guy he is. I'm going to be Black Adam. I'm going to be in Skyscraper or whatever that movie was. Like, I'm going to be this big action star. And by going this way and being in an A24 feature and seeing that it's going to underperform and doing it anyway, right? Like, he's clearly making a pivot. And I hope for what it's worth, he sticks with it. Like, and I think acknowledging that, yeah, this movie bombed, but you know what? That's not what it's about, is in a way some kind of growth. I hope that's him growing and saying, hey, I see that. I see where I'm headed. I know this is not the most popular decision, but I don't want to be Mr. Popular right now. You know, I've done that for 30 years. Like, I built a freaking dynasty. Like, I want to do unique projects. I really want to reach for something great. And, like, I think he can do that. We've seen him in a lot of fantastic roles. I love him in Pain and Gain. Like, and so it's cool to see him doing stuff like this again, even if it's not that successful. What do you think? Big bomb? Is he falling flat on his face? I see it as character growth. Where are you at?
So I've heard, or what people have noticed, is that The Rock's brand used to just print gold, and he was the King Midas of the box office. Anything he made, people loved because he was so charismatic on screen. But his brand is just kind of faded in the last 4 or 5 years, and he's tried to pivot into to dominate something. You know, he tried it with DC as Black Adam. I'm going to change the hierarchy. We're going to do this thing. Black Adam bomb. That doesn't happen. He apparently tried to go back to WWE. Similar thing. Didn't really break back into wrestling the way he wanted to. So now he's trying to kind of pivot more into being a serious actor, which is interesting, but I'm not sure if it's going to work. He's definitely going for an Oscar with this role, but the Academy famously doesn't really respect the movie star. Tom Cruise, the biggest example of that. Tom Cruise has been nominated twice for an Oscar. Should have won in '88 for Born on the 4th of July, probably, or Magnolia. But they don't really like the glitz and glamour. They want someone who kind of isn't super successful, sure, but pushes the art form forward. So it's going to be a hard pivot if he wants to be super serious actor. I think it's going to take several of these kinds of roles. I also wanted to talk a little bit about his physique change. The Rock was diagnosed with some sort of heart condition several months ago, something pretty serious, where he basically had to stop. He clearly stopped all the steroids he was taking.
I thought it was a personal choice. Oh, okay. All right.
So he has not said that, but that's, we all know why. But because of this heart thing and him stopping the supplements, he's his physique is just drastically changing. And he claims he's also trying to get really, really skinny for this new role where he plays an older guy. So that's part of it, though. But he does have this legitimate health condition that's kind of, he's pushed his body so much in that he's accurate, like responsibly addressing it, but it's made him a lot smaller. We've seen the same thing with Dave Bautista. He's lost a bunch of weight in the last couple of years because also slimming down after not being on the juice anymore. So that's also going to affect his career.
Blame it on the juice. I forgot about the supplements, man. You're kind of right. Yeah, you can't do that stuff forever. Both of them have slimmed down. All right, that's compelling. That's compelling for sure. But for what it's worth, he says this is the direction he wants his career to run in, and I support that. And so I think there's no better way to jump into talking about the Smashing Machine. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this one. Andy, please take it away.
The Smashing Machine? So this is the latest feature from Safdie Brother, Benny Safdie. I got it right. This film has had a really interesting journey. It's based on a kind of proto MMA fighter, Mark Kerr, who was part of when the sport was getting started in the 90s. People wanted something that was bloodier, more brutal than boxing, and that's when mixed martial arts started. And a lot of these early versions of it were really brutal. They didn't have a whole lot of rules. They had really big mismatches. And he was kind of one of the early pioneers of this sport. So this film came to be when Dwayne The Rock Johnson, he sees this 2002 documentary about fighter Mark Kerr, and he really identifies with this guy, and he goes to Benny Safdie and says, hey, I want to make a movie based on this documentary, based on this fighter. And so they work it out, and that's how this movie came to be. And so our story about Mark Kerr, it follows him between 1997 and 2000. He was this hulking, huge guy. He was like 6'4", 260, 270, a grappler, a wrestler. I mean, just the size of the guy, he was really hard to beat. But we see him towards the beginning of the film, he suffers his first loss, and it really, really messes with his head. The film it's a little unfocused, but it deals with his addiction to opioids, painkillers from fighting, his troubled relationship with his girlfriend Dawn, played by Emily Blunt, drama inside the ring, outside the ring. They're changing rules constantly because the fights are too fast or they're too dangerous. There's a lot going on in the film, and it's filmed in that Safdie style. If you're familiar with things like The Curse or Uncut Gems, it's very art house. It's not quite as fast paced as you might think. It's almost a period piece because it looks like a VHS from the 2000s or the late 90s. The Rock does a pretty incredible transformation and performance because he bulked up for this. He got really big, bigger than he normally is. He's hulking. And that's unfortunately one of the things I'm not sure the Academy will really recognize. But also there's lots of facial prosthetics to make him look different. And he's a very soft-spoken guy, which is kind of the crazy thing, because you think of these big MMA fighters being like super macho and aggressive, and he's the opposite. When he's in the ring, he's a killer. But outside the ring, he's like a big teddy bear. And so it's this interesting juxtaposition. Lots to talk about. Zach, what do you think?
So I think The Smashing Machine is, like you said, you kind of nailed it perfect. I think it's unfocused. Like, I think what we all are expecting to happen in The Smashing Machine is a thing we've seen in a lot of historical sports biopics, which hurts the movie and hurts the box office for what it's worth. I think we all see this big hulking Mark Kerr, this man who is capable of so much pain and violence and physical, like, you know, violence. And we think that by the end of the movie, something awful or violent or tragic is going to befall him. Like, it's just what's going to happen, right? He's going to freak out, or he's going to OD, or he's going to get in a car accident. Like, something terrible is going to happen to this guy. Like, we have seen sports biopics like this before, much like music biopics. Like, that's part of the reason I think it hurt at the box office. And, like, Smashing Machine isn't really about that. And that's a good thing. I think for those out there who are, like, big film goers, who like going to see movies, maybe listen to this podcast, like, you're probably going to like that that's not necessarily what the story is here. But the story we have left is stunningly similar to the 2002 documentary. I actually watched a little over half of it today, prepping for the show. I found it online. It is crazy how much of it is the same. If you go watch it, you will be shocked by how much of it is like almost dialogue word for word lifted from the documentary. Which leaves you feeling like Safdie didn't really make his own thing here. Like, it definitely just feels like it's a dramatization of something else. Like, the plot is the same. Like, scenes are word for word the same. And watching the documentary is immediately more engaging and attractive than watching the fictional version of it. Because one of them is real people riffing off of themselves and their consciousness and who they are and speaking from the heart. Kerr talking about who he is. Dawn talking about her role in his life. Mark Coleman, opposite him, played by Ryan Bader in a first time feature film performance, who's tremendous. He's in that a lot. Like, he's a big part of it. All of that is a lot more interesting than I think what's happening here in Smashing Machine. So what are you left with, right? You're left with The Rock putting on this incredible larger-than-life performance. Mark Kerr is huge. He's three times the size of anybody else that shows up in this movie. It's insane how big he is. And he's this guy who is so sensitive and is such a small person inside of this huge hulking body. He's got this soft voice. He is such a nice guy. But as soon as that bell goes off, he is ready to pound sand, right? Like, and anybody on the other side of him is going to be a pulp, right? There's going to be nothing left of him. That's interesting. And that's good. But I think the movie doesn't manage to stick anywhere specific. It doesn't land a bullseye anywhere. And like, without that, you end up with a movie that just feels a little bit hollow, especially because there's a documentary that's just like it that already came out that you can go find online for free.
Yeah, it's shot in a very documentary style, that kind of fixed camera or like a news camera following them around. And the whole time I was thinking, I was like, I would rather watch a documentary about this guy. That seems like it would be... kind of just more accurate or just more interesting. And I think that's one of the things. This is very strangely paced. It is very slow and it's a little boring. And I was like, we got 20 again, you get 20 minutes in and you kind of know how it's gonna go. And I was like, oh no. Oh, this is so slow. It's a whole thing
just,
this way. And it
feel
it is,
oh, come over you.
Yeah. And I don't really know why. Like, it's like the slowest movie about a fighter or like boxing that I've ever seen. Like, I was just like dreadful. There aren't really that many fights. There's kind of there's a montage at the beginning. There's a fight at the end of the first act. And then there's like an hour without any of that. And so I think that hurts the box office, because who is this for? It's not for MMA fight like fans. Like, they're going to be bored out of their minds. It's more for indie film fans. But I mean, a lot of people may be deterred by the violence, but the pacing was just really slow. And like I said, there's too many storylines going on and they're all unfocused. The movie reminded me a lot of The Wrestler. Darren Aronofsky, I couldn't remember his name. Darren Aronofsky.
Mickey Rooney. Yeah.
Film not Mickey from Rooney. 2000. I can't remember.
Who's
his
the
name.
Wrestler?
Mickey
Damn,
Rourke.
Mickey Rourke. I was like, not Mickey Rooney. He's in the 50s. That's not him. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I put you on the right spot. Go ahead.
So Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler, which is an incredible film about a man who is essentially addicted to wrestling. He's pro wrestling, not like Olympic wrestling. And he's addicted to the glitz, the glamour, the crowd. And that character starts to make a comeback both inside and outside the ring. And, you know, he's working on things with his daughter, but it's so much where that film is about his tragic downfall because of his addiction to the sport. And it's really focused in that way. And it's a great film. It's really tragic as well. And this is just, it's about too many things. And the drama is just kind of missing. Like, their relationship, there's a really dramatic scene late in the film that feels really unearned, kind of comes out of nowhere. His addiction is kind of just, he gets addicted and then gets over it, gets sober really quickly too. It kind of happens in passing. It's just, it's so unfocused, and if it would have been about a fewer things and made and developed them more, I think it would have been more interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting watching The Rock in this role, because you kind of engage with this metatextual feeling that, like, he has obviously experienced a lot of the same emotions Kerr does, right? He's this huge hulking wrestler. He looks great in the ring. Like, that's where he's most natural. That's where he built his career. So when Kerr is struggling with addiction, you start to wonder a little bit, has Dwayne Johnson ever struggled with this stuff? You know, when Kerr is arguing with his girlfriend and keeping it contained, but then like he can't help but like want to take out some of that aggression and tears a door off the hinges. It's like, that ever happened to Johnson? You know, like, you get this, you get that connection in the theater for sure. And I think that's part of what makes Dwayne Johnson's performance here so electric. Like, there are certain scenes in here where he's trying to negotiate with Japanese business owners who run this thing about his payment, or he's trying to get pain medication. He's talking to his trainer about this, like, this situation that's happened to him. That stuff all feels really authentic. Like, and that stuff feels really good. We should talk about Emily Blunt. I did not mind her so much first time through, and man, I came out of the theater and a lot of people were like, she is not awesome in this. And I think you were the first one to identify that, and since then I've kind of thought about it and I've realized there's a lot of great points that I didn't see. I was impressed by the fact that she's like not speaking in her traditional accent, but she doesn't have the benefit of prosthetics like her does, short of augmented breasts, which I didn't know about till I was listening to another podcast. Otherwise, like, she kind of just looks like her and she's kind of doing her thing. And when Johnson is going for like Oscar work in like heavy prosthesis, like, she kind of just seems like she doesn't have a big enough role here as Dawn, the girlfriend, who's like not really a great fit for him. They've got these problems, like domestic issues. What do you think, Andy?
As Roger Ebert famously said about Shelley Duvall in The Shining, she's written as shrieking dish rag. Yeah. I felt this was a really kind of painfully kind of misogynistic role. She's just annoying girlfriend. That's her role. Every time she comes into the scene, she's not a downer, but everyone on screen is like, why are you here? Everyone's like her is chumming it up with the boys and he's having a good time. She walks in the room. It's a drag for everyone else.
The movie hates her. Yeah. It's really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. She's just written very one dimensional and she's just there to be annoying. And she's not like, she's trying to like make his protein shake. And he's like, you didn't make it right. You're not paying attention to me. Like, he only complains and she's trying to like help out his life and his career. And is the only one like, concerned about his addiction, which I think there's a little bit of an interesting look at masculinity here, where his closest relationships are with his other fighters, his trainers, his other kind of male friends, and his girlfriend is just this annoying person that they don't want her around when he's training, when he's going to fights. And it's, I think you could have written that role a whole lot better. She is completely wasted, and like I said, she's just annoying girlfriend number one.
Yeah, like it's really a shame. Like, as the movie kind of starts and gets going, I felt like, okay, the two of them have this like cycle of problems, right? One of them will do something wrong, the other one gets upset, and then the other one does this, and this happens, and you know, she doesn't really work, and he seems to make all the money, so she tries to take care of him and doesn't always get it right, but she's trying her best. And then behind closed doors, she's a little different, and like, but yeah, nobody in the movie likes her. Everybody dislikes her. Everybody thinks she's bad for Mark and she should get out of there. And then the movie mostly draws her that way. And it's really tough. She's a lead weight in the film. Like, every time she's on screen, it hits the brakes. And it's weird because you'd think you'd know this in scripting if you're putting it together, but there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of scripting. There's a script here, but again, it is nearly lifted wholesale from the doc. This is Benny Safdie copying somebody else's homework. And I wish it wasn't, like, because it doesn't seem like Josh is doing that with Marty Supreme. They're both doing historic sports biopics, but this one is just so direct one-to-one from that doc. And I did want to mention, before I keep hammering this, and we should move on to Final Rex, but where it comes from, you know, you already explained that Dwayne Johnson had approached Safdie about doing this project. He came to Safdie with the doc in like 2019 and said, hey, I want to do this. Let me know what you think. Safdie said in interviews that COVID put the brakes on the whole thing and it just sits. But he said that he kept seeing photos on his phone and he kept thinking about it. And Benny Safdie just keeps wandering back to this idea of Mark Kerr and the Smashing Machine. That's part of the reason he wanted to make it. And walking out of the theater, I was thinking about that and thinking, you know, I guess part of the point is like unrealized potential. Like, the idea that, like, you can be something great even if history doesn't remember you so much, that, like, your life can be one of tremendous opportunity and growth even if you don't get there. Because, like, when I watch The Smash Machine, that's what it feels like. It feels like a movie that's supposed to be something lofty and tremendous, but, like, it just doesn't end up getting over the line. It doesn't have that pop or that swing or that, I don't know, that movie magic that, like, turns it into an Oscar winner, you know? Like, it just feels good. But then I talked to you about it on this podcast, and you remind me that it got a 15-minute standing ovation at Venice Film Festival, and they gave him like the silver palm d'or. Yeah, right. Like, it was going to be the greatest feature ever. Yeah, weird. And it seems like a film that's supposed to be a worldwide phenomenon and just kind of isn't. Yeah. Any other thoughts or recommendations? I feel like that's dour.
Yeah, a couple of things. Number one, some people pointed out like Mark Kerr wasn't really an important part of MMA. Like he was a renowned fighter, but he wasn't like a champion. He didn't like have an incredible win streak, or he was just kind of a huge ass dude that fought for a little bit. So it's you have someone that's not super consequential to the sport. And also the last thing I want to talk about is the budget. This is a $50 million film. That is a lot for A24. That's a lot for an indie art house movie. Usually you're going to spend like $20 to $30 million, and that even that might be a lot for an Oscar film. Like The Brutalist from last year, $10-15 million. Usually these budgets are way smaller. They went way over. I mean, and it looks good. That like the fights look good. They're in this big crowded auditorium. Benny Safdie talks about 400 extras and just like these crazy big sets. And you know, that part looks convincing, but it's just too expensive. Like they're gonna lose a ton of money on this.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you know how much The Rock made for it? I don't know if they ever published that stuff.
I'm sure he took some of a pay cut, but he's not cheap.
No, I'm sure a sizable portion of that budget went straight to him. And then Blunt's a partner of his, right? They did Jungle Cruise. Like they both get along great. That's part of the reason she's in this. Like I'm sure she got something as well. Otherwise, like it's a very slim cast. Ryan Bader in his first film role, as far as I know, is a UFC guy who's very good. It reminds me a lot of Kevin Garnett in Uncut Gems, right? It's the second time I've seen a Safdie brother turn out a great performance from an athlete who does not act. Like, really solid. Ryan Bader should do more work. Alexander Usyk is in this movie, who is currently UFC fighter and legend and Olympic athlete. Like, we've seen a pay-per-view. Usyk, excuse me. I'm sorry. Boxer. Smash Machine has a small cast, big heart, bigger star. I don't know if it quite gets there. Anyway, final reviews, recommendations. Andy, would you recommend The Smashing Machine?
This is going to be a soft pass, I think. I kind of struggled getting through it. It's really slow. It's trying to do a great thing, be a great sports biopic. It just kind of misses the mark. It's really unfocused. It's about too many things. The drama's not there. The emotion's not there. The Rock does turn out a performance. He alone is worth watching, but I think most like fight fans are going to be bored. Indie fans might be okay. Maybe catch it on streaming if you're interested.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think Smashing Machine just kind of doesn't work. Yeah, if you're into sports biopics, check it out. If you're curious about The Rock, wait for streaming. You don't need to go rush to the theater to see it. It's a good time, but it's not a great time, and I think that's what hurts it. And also, yeah, check out the doc, because the documentary from 2002 is almost the same, and it's free on the internet. I'm sure you can find it somewhere. That's it. That's Smashing Machine. We should talk about some upcoming trailers, some things that are coming. I'm taking the first one here, but Andy, if you wouldn't mind introducing the segment, I sure would appreciate it.
It's time for the trailer park.
Perfect. So our first trailer we're going to look at is a film called The Carpenter's Son. This is scheduled to come out November 14th. This is a very small indie horror feature from Lotfi Natan. Nathan, maybe? Looks like it's pronounced Nathan. Lotfi Nathan Natan, who is an Egyptian director, who's done just a few small features, nothing very big. This seems to be his first larger feature, starring Nicolas Cage, Noah Jupe, and FKA Twigs as three biblical entities. I had this wrong last time we talked about this. Andy corrected me. Nicolas Cage plays, I think, Joseph, right? FKA Twigs, I think, plays Mary. Noah Jupe plays young child Jesus. Child Jesus, of course. Teen Jesus. And he's haunted. Haunted by the devil or demons or something out in the desert. So as he starts to see these miracles and grow into his own, him and his family begin to realize that there is something afoot out there with them. That's the movie. It comes on November 14th. Odd biblical Christian horror. I'm into it. And by Christian horror, I don't mean like by Angel Studios Christian horror. I mean like odd, weird indie horror about Christianity. Could be cool. Could be lame. What do you think, Andy?
I remember seeing the teaser for this and being really interested. And yeah, I thought Nicolas Cage was playing Jesus. No, he's playing Joseph. This looks really creepy. I was really creeped out by this. It's got some of that, a little bit of Passion of the Christ energy, but it's got some pretty violent looking scenes. But it looks like a mother and a father who don't understand their son. Their son, just called the boy, played by Noah Jupe, will face off against the devil by a young girl called Isla Johnston, who I've never heard of before. But man, the whole thing just looks real creepy. Cage going full Cage in a couple of scenes, which we love. If he's going to be on screen, we got to see him go over the top. I'm definitely into whatever's happening here.
Yeah, it looks fun. It looks like something you and I might go see at like a small indie theater in town and, you know, 90 minutes and we'll come out being like, well, that was lame, or like actually something special. So keep it here on Off Script. We'll cover it when it comes around in November. Also, I'm thinking about Noah Jupe. If you don't know who he is, he's not one of the Stranger Kids things. He's in that movie Honey Boy, starring Shia LaBeouf. That's Noah Jupe.
Oh, that's
that
right.
Kid. Yeah, it's the young Shia LaBeouf kid in that movie. He plays young Shia LaBeouf's character, which is supposed to be on himself. Anyway, that's Carpenter's Son coming November 14th. What's next, Andy?
Pillion. So this is an indie film that I've heard a little bit of buzz about. It stars Alexander Skarsgård and Harry Melling. As a couple that develops this dom-sub relationship, and in this film, Harry Melling is like really super kind of ugly, and Alexander Skarsgård is this dashing, incredibly attractive biker that takes him on as his sub. And apparently it's about that kind of relationship and dynamic, but it is very much not a respectful one. Like, Harry Melling's getting disrespected the whole time. He's like, why are you still here? You need to leave. So apparently there was lots of sexually graphic scenes. They pared some of that down. It's been getting some buzz. It looks interesting, looks funny. It's got a funny tone by the trailer. What do you think?
I was going to say this is probably the most attractive Harry Melling's ever looked in a movie compared to what? The Harry Potter films where he plays Harry's older cousin who's a fat moron, and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs where he has no arms and legs, and you were like, this ugly guy, this guy sucks. Like, hold on, give him a break. I don't know. I thought this was going to be some hardcore whips and chain gang stuff, and then all these... this ad comes out and I start seeing like early quotes for it, and people are like, actually, it's really sweet and surprisingly sentimental. I saw somebody list it as a romantic comedy. Like, I thought this was going to be some hardcore, like, be, you know, I don't know, whips and chains. And it turns out like it is that, but also it's like kind of sweet and thoughtful. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but it seems really odd and interesting. So I'm into Pillion. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Much more so with this teaser than what I'd heard previous, like rumblings of it getting made. We were like, okay, yeah, that sounds like a weird indie. This actually looks, I don't know, could be something cool. It's a teaser. A24 will have a full trailer out, I'm sure, soon. And right now it's a coming soon. We have no official date. That's Pillion. One more to talk about. We got to talk about Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. Yeah, we've talked about Frankenstein before, but we're going to talk about it again. This is scheduled to come out theatrically this month, October 17th, right? Like just a week and change from when we're recording this show right now. But that's limited. Limited theatrical release. It'll be out for like 2 weeks, and then it's coming to Netflix on November 7th. All right, that's the deal. Almost 3 weeks, 20 days, something like that, 2021. And Frankenstein is a very faithful, as we understand it, retelling of the Frankenstein story. Dr. Victor Frankenstein, a mad scientist, creates a man from the remains of other men, brings him to life with a bolt of lightning in a big fancy lab. That monster man goes out, travels the world, and tells his story through some kind of, I don't know, diary entries. We've got Jacob Elordi as the monster playing against type. He is covered in, I don't know, rags. You can't really get a good look at him. He does reveal his face at the end of the trailer, but it just kind of looks like tired old monster Jacob Elordi. You've got Oscar Isaac playing Dr. Frankenstein. Very exciting. Playing him very punk rock, as I understand it. He's got kind of this longer hair. And Mia Goth shows up in here in a fancy Guillermo del Toro period-appropriate dress with all the trimmings. Reminds me a lot of, what's her name in Crimson Peak? Yeah. It looks a lot like Crimson Peak. Yeah, no, it's not just... Well, she's in Crimson Peak, but definitely. Who else is in Crimson Peak? Who's
Mia Wasikowska. Girl?
Mia Wasikowska. Right, yes. Not Mia Goth.
We'll get there.
The Alice in Wonderland gal. Yeah. No, her, yes. Looks a lot like that. Anyway, I've talked too much about Frankenstein. Limited release, October 17th. Full Netflix release, November 7th. Andy, what do you think?
The trailer looks interesting, but it also kind of looks cheap at the same time. It looks like season 3 of Wednesday. In a lot of it, it just looks, it's got that cheap Netflix sheen on it where they're cutting corners here and there. Part of it looks expensive. Part of it looks cheap. It has not been positively reviewed out of the festivals. It's super long. It's 2.5 hours. I can tell you right now, that's too long for what's going on here. It does look interesting. I will give it a chance. I don't think it's going to kind of land like they're kind of hoping it will. But it looks interesting, and we have a great cast, at least, and people have praised Jacob Elordi's The Creature, that performance. So I'm interested to see what it is, but also kind of apprehensive.
Yeah, I'm not encouraged by the festival buzz. People seem to be really lukewarm on it. And I feel like everybody was looking forward to it like us, but Del Toro's in a weird space. He's doing a lot of work with Netflix. That's hit or miss, right? If Frankenstein is a miss, Pinocchio was a big hit. I know that's stop motion, but even still, right? Like, I am hoping for something akin to like Nightmare Alley. This seems like it might be more Shape of Water, but with a Netflix budget. So like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm bummed. I'm bummed to hear it's maybe not that hot. I'm going to try to keep it tight. I would love to see it in theaters if we get the chance, but I know we're doing some traveling for the show. Actually, not for the show. We're doing some traveling around the show. We'll work it out. We'll keep you posted here when we find out more. Until then, one more film to talk about this week. This one is odd. And let me tell you, before we jump into it, I was not planning on watching this movie for the podcast. I had three different people reach out to me and ask me if we were covering this in the show. And three people never asked me if we're covering anything on the show. So that was a big surprise. And I felt like, well, okay, all right. People seem interested. Maybe we should go check it out. So I hit up Andy last week. We decided late in the week we should try to squeeze this one in. Fortunately, it's about 76 minutes in length, so it's not all that long. It's an indie horror feature from Shudder and IFC called The Good Boy. So, Good Boy is the story of Indy, a very wonderful little dog that is in some sort of haunted house, some sort of haunted, demonic something situation with this very meaningful owner named Todd, who is present, but kind of just hanging out in the background for the movie. Think like the parents from Peanuts, right? Or like the mom and Tom and Jerry. You kind of have your human character, like you see the feet, you see him in the background, you never really see him head up. They're just kind of doing their thing. They're on their own track. And Todd is out at the old family homestead to get away from the world and kind of reset, get away from his digital trappings and maybe some problems at home where he lives alone, I think, with him and his dog Indy to hopefully just get out to the wilderness for a while. But while out there, there start to be some bumps in the night. There start to be some things that go wrong. And Indy, while Todd is asleep and, you know, milling about, being himself, has to kind of travel into the house and figure out what's going on. Could be something upstairs, could be done something downstairs, or maybe something in that nefarious basement, right, with that door under the stairs where anything could be going on. It is a quick movie, 76 minutes, and uniquely shot mostly in the house of the director. It took about 3 years to make. The director is named Ben Leonberg. It's his dog. Indy is his dog. And he shot it along with his wife, who helped him put together most of the movie. You wouldn't know it if not for some behind-the-scenes stuff that maybe we'll talk about at the end. But otherwise, I want to focus on the movie proper. The movie is Good Boy. Andy, what'd you think?
So I enjoyed this more than I thought I was. I'm not a dog person. I'm not a dog film person particularly. I think it helps that they used a real dog, like the real dog Indy, and they showed some behind the scenes stuff where they really have to do a lot of animated things to get him, you know, to react the way they want. But I think that really helped the film. This is creepier than I thought. Like it is, it kind of gets under your skin a little bit. It is filled with kind of stereotypical horror things, you know, bump in the night, shadows, there's what's that sound downstairs. But it is interesting seeing it from the dog's perspective. Like a lot of times when you go into a haunted house, you'll, you know, like people have strange dreams or they have visions. And we see that through the dog's perspective. The dog has strange dreams and the dog has strange visions. It also does a smart thing if we never really see our protagonists above the waist or on their face, really. So it does really keep the perspective on the dog. This reminded me strangely of Skinamarink in a way, where you have a lot of peering into the darkness, peering through, like what is that? Is that a shadow or a man? That sort of thing. It's creepier than I thought. It's not scary, but it might be for some. And I feel like it's shot really well. A lot of times these shutter things look really, really cheap. And this is shot, like I said, it's shot convincingly well in this in Ben Leonberg's house, which I think kind of helped things. So I really enjoyed this more than I thought I would.
Yeah, the dog is perfect. Indy is an amazing dog for this feature. He's cute and he seems smart, and ultimately, like, he's kind of quiet. He does not bark a lot. So he's very good at looking kind of serious and like looking in this direction, looking in that direction. And like, it seems like that's a lot of what's going on in the movie, right? The dog doesn't know he's in a movie, but like, he has to kind of seem like something is serious or wrong. And I think that's part of the reason that the illusion of horror works so good, because our protagonist is powerless. He cannot do anything to stop whatever might be coming. The most he could do is bark and maybe bite, but otherwise he has to like run, hide, try to get his owner's attention. And there's a lot of like really good dog stuff in this movie that isn't just limited to like the horror. Just a few minutes into it, after title cards, we get this wonderful montage of Indy growing up, like from puppy and being adopted to like running around in a field with their owner and get a little older, get a little bigger. And like, I'm not a dog owner, I'm a cat owner. But like, just that montage, just that first few minutes is emotional in its own way, because you see the life of this like animal come together and how sweet they are and all these wonderful moments, right? As far as I know, Ben used his own footage along with probably stock footage to put that together. But like, outside of that, once we get into the movie proper, like, that Indy has no power. Like, Todd takes him to the house. Indy doesn't want to get out of the car. He's like, come on, we're going, you know? They go up to the house, and he's like, I don't want to go in there. He's like, come on, we're doing it. Like, your protagonist is just continually pulled in and just has no say. And then when Todd leaves for work one day, Indy's like left at the door and starts doing that thing all dogs do, where he kind of starts crying and whining and runs and like sits in a window. And then it does a jump cut from like afternoon to night, and Indy's just still parked in that window, just waiting, like just looking out for this guy to come home. Like, he has no control over what's going on in the house. He has no agency. So following this creature that cannot talk and cannot emote, like, really, in a horror movie, kind of works. It kind of works good, like, better than I thought it would be, even if the scares aren't like really brutal, visceral scares. Like, it's a lot more tonal, it's a lot more atmosphere. Skinamarink is a really great comparison. I thought of that mostly because it's a lot of mid-century modern house stuff, right? Like, it's a house like you and I have lived in our lives. And it's a lot of still camera work, for sure. Like, when you're trying to direct a dog, you don't want to have a camera moving around a lot, because animals look at cameras. So it's a lot of, like, camera up in the corner, camera over here, down here under a chair. You know, a lot of, like, sneaky stuff like that, with appropriate movements, for sure. Like, there's some good stuff in there. But a lot of pans. I thought a lot of, like, presence, the Steven Soderbergh movie. Yep. Like, we watched that. Yeah, similar kind of vibe. Like, there's something kind of going on here, but we don't know what. I think all of that works good, for sure. I think where Good Boy falls apart is it does end up being a little boring. Like, I was thinking of titles for the thumbnail for this, and I thought of, like, Good Boar, which isn't very funny. But, like, there are moments where it drags, for sure, where it's like, okay, nothing's really going on, or we know that Indy senses something and we can't really figure out what it is. In those moments, the short runtime helps immensely, because we move through it pretty quick. Even if it starts to get a little slow or there's a lull, if you get up and go to the bathroom or check your phone or something, by the time you're back on it, like, you're there. So those are small complaints in a movie that otherwise is like a pretty good creative exercise, I think.
Yeah, I think our human characters could have been fleshed out a little bit more. Maybe you could do some flashback to, you know, just building their characters, and that would have added onto the runtime a little bit, maybe fleshed it out. Also, I mean, this is done on the barest of budgets. You know, if you could have had some more human characters than the few you have, I think that would have helped. I do like that it's kind of a mystery what's going on. Like most haunted house things, it's like, why is it haunted? Why is this evil here? Where did it come from? What does it want? And we spend a long part of the film trying to figure out those things. Is it, because there's so many things. Is it a good spirit? Is it a bad spirit? Is it trapped? Is it malignant? Like, what are we expecting here?
And is the house haunted? Is the man haunted? Yeah, right. Like, how does this work? Yeah, what are the rules?
And it takes its time kind of revealing those things. So that's the part that I enjoyed. It does have that experimental feel. It's a lot of the camera looking in dark corners and just waiting. And like I said, it's fairly slow paced, but like I said, I was like, I'm enjoying this more because it is such a creative thing, more than like the Smashing Machine for instance.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, no, and like some really smart decisions in the production too. Like, again, Indy's a great pick, but like choosing to have Todd always wear a plaid shirt is just smart because you immediately recognize him every time. Like it immediately is like in every flashback, in every one of those opening montage shots I talked about, the emotional stuff, he's wearing some sort of plaid. Or like it's subtle, but it works. And it establishes in your head that that guy's owner, he's good. Like he's good for dog. Indy and him are tight. That works. They do it in the opening shots. Like it's all the way through the movie. The sister, Vera, who Todd talks to via speakerphone. Every time they talk, they're on speaker. It always shows the phone and says Vera on there. We always hear her. So the audience get to hear their conversation, even though Indy does not understand it. Even though Indy doesn't really recognize that person's name, we still get to see that the camera is on screen, so we know who he is talking to. Like, that stuff works good. There's a neighbor character at one point, like, who immediately has some identifiable traits about them that you recognize. So if they come up later, you'll be like, oh, that guy, I remember that. Like, that stuff is all important for establishing, like, a cinematic language when the dog can't talk, right? Like, some of your big challenges of having a protagonist who doesn't speak. So, like, in that way, like, having a passive protagonist take an active role in a horror feature is challenging and smart. And I think Good Boy's good stuff. I don't think it's a great horror movie. You know, the ultimately the mystery and the scares when they all come down to it are acceptable. They're fine. And if you're a horror fan, like it's October, Halloween, throw it on. It's on Shudder, right? That's where it'll be. Great service for it. ISC worked on it. But it's a really good dog movie. That's what I think. I think if you're a dog owner, you will really enjoy this movie. If you're a horror fan and you don't own a dog, you'll be fine with it. You'll be like, yeah, it's creative. Yeah, it's good. You know. But yeah, any other thoughts, Andy, for recommendations?
Yeah, unfortunately, because it is such a small budget, that's where it would be more interesting. Like Presence, if it could have a few more actors in it, if you could have more lore, more backstory, flesh the idea out a little bit. I'm sure they had a very small budget that they had to stay within. That definitely could help it more. And this might work better in a different genre. Maybe not. It's interesting in horror, but maybe action or maybe a different storyline where, you know, there's more characters involved, but you're still seeing things from the perspective of the dog. But still an interesting project and approach to film.
Andy, would you recommend Good Boy?
I'd recommend it for dog people and horror people. If you're already subscribed to Shudder, it'll be there shortly, I'm sure. It's definitely made for the theatrical experience. I could tell, like, it's got that kind of direction with the way the blocking and the just overall cinematography. It's meant for that big screen experience, but it'll work at home just fine.
Yeah, I think Good Boy's a good time. I think if you're a dog owner, you should check it out. If you're not a dog owner, or maybe you don't care as much, like, it's a fine horror movie. It's a really good dog movie. Ben Leonberg directed it and co-wrote the script with Alex Cannon. Ben, keep making movies. Keep putting this dog in your movies. This dog rocks. He's a movie star. Keep making movies with Indy. He's very good. It's a very good dog movie. So, yeah. And for all the studios that want to do a CGI dog going forward, right? Like, what was it? Call of the Wild with Harrison Ford. This is how you do a dog movie. It's hard, but it's not super hard, right? It's manageable. So, yeah. I don't want to talk about spoilers because we don't do spoilers on this podcast, but that's kind of the wrap up for Good Boy. Really quick, can we talk a bit about the end credits for Good Boy? Can we issue a spoiler proclamation here and tell people if they haven't seen it that you should get? Do you want to talk about that at all, Andy? Because I do.
Yes, I don't think that that's a spoiler because it's not about the movie. If you stay after the
movie, I hear you. Yeah, all right.
If you stay after the credits, you get some behind the scenes of how they shot the film with director Ben Leonberg. And he just kind of explains the difference between what's going on in camera, what you see versus what they had to do, like to get the dog to look different ways. They're like being really loud and animated and thing. And it might just be really quiet in the scene. So there's a lot of that kind of juxtaposition. They could only film for maybe 3 hours a day. That's about how much energy the dog had. And they might get 8 seconds of footage or something. It took 3 years. So it's very interesting, kind of strange also to have it at the end.
Yeah, it's such a weird move. It's so funny. When I saw this, there was a guy sitting in the row in front of me, and he got up at one of the worst times ever to get up and get popcorn. It was like right at the climax of the movie. And he got up to get a popcorn refill or leave. I thought he might be leaving because the twist when it's revealed is like right at this climactic moment. And I thought he might just be like, yep, I got it. I'm out of here. This movie sucks. I don't know what he thought. But he comes back right as it hits credits. He sits in his chair and credits pop up, like directed by Ben Lienberg. And I was like, that is hilariously bad timing to get a popcorn refill. You miss the whole end of the damn movie. But then you hang out through the credits and there's a surprise end credit sequence. There's not really a tease yet for a follow-up here. But that end credit sequence, like Andy said, is like an 11-minute featurette. That's like, hi, I'm Ben Lienberg. This is my dog, Indy. Here's how we made this movie. And it's all about the making of it and how difficult it was to make and the challenge and why it's like such an accomplishment. And like, I see all that. It was baffling to me at the time because it so undermines the horror of the movie. It gives away the whole illusion. It's like if David Copperfield at the end of a presentation goes, and now, here's how all the magic happened. Let me show you every trick. Here's how we did this. Here's how we pulled that. We pulled this thing over here and that trapdoor opens. Isn't that cool? Thanks, guys. Enjoy the show. And I thought that was so weird. I thought it was so weird that you would make a horror movie and then at the end go, here's how we made all of it. You know, normally that's like DVD commentary stuff, behind the scenes stuff. But ultimately, it leaves you leaving the theater with a different emotion. It's not, that was a fine horror movie. It's, that was a really great dog movie. Because showing you how the dog works and how he worked with the dog and how they made this all possible, like, really underlines, like, the larger exercise here, which is not that this is a horror feature, but that it's a dog movie. And like, I, in that way, I was really charmed by it, and maybe more movies should do it, but it was very odd. I was like, oh, it was like a YouTube video. I was like, oh my God, there's like a, like a 10 minute how it's made at the end here. And I had so much enjoyed what I'd seen already. I guess I didn't think that, like, you know, average moviegoers don't know how any of that happens. Like, that to them, that's all a surprise. And everybody stuck around to watch. Nobody got up and left. Everybody in my theater was into it.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like I said, it's interesting to see. It does kind of, it's a big jarring shift from the rest of the film. The struggles of independent filmmaking, because it's, they're using his house, his dog, him and his wife shooting all this stuff. So it's it's interesting.
It's interesting. Yeah, it was very odd. I can't remember the last time I saw a movie in theaters and got to the end and they were like, here's the behind the scenes of like a when the film came out. And this is a limited release. Like, it was a very interesting button to put on the end of that movie to decide before it goes to theaters, hey, you know what? We should include this thing on the end so that when people walk out of the theater, this is what they're thinking about. And like, it, on the one hand, it seems to undermine parts of the film. On the other hand, I think it does the best. Highlights what's so great about it, which is this dog and his relationship with his owner, which is important. So with that, we should wrap up the episode 310 of Offscript Film Review. What are we watching next week, Andy?
So we're going to be watching Tron: Ares, the long-awaited third film in the Tron series, starring Greta Lee, Evan Peters, and Jared Leto. Looking to see what that is, score by Nine Inch Nails, that everyone's really excited. And we're also going to be checking out The Woman in Cabin 10 on Netflix. Is a new release this Friday, starring Keira Knightley as a woman who witnesses someone go overboard on a ship cruise. And no one believes her. They're like, no, everyone's accounted for. Some sort of mystery on the high seas. That's out this Friday, October 10th as well. FYI releases, Derek C. and Francis' Roofman, starring... Oh, I'm blanking.
Channing Tatum. Hey, we've been doing an hour. You're all right. Yeah, I get it.
Channing Tatum. Yeah. And Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah, yeah.
That's out this week today. That's another indie film that there's been some buzz about. We're going to be skipping that. Maybe we'll review it a little bit later towards award season, but that's also out. But next week, Tron: Ares and Woman in Cabin 10.
If you enjoyed the podcast today, if you like what we're doing here on Offscript, the best way you can support us is just subscribe to the podcast. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite outlet, YouTube. We got a lot of things going on over there. You can also like, comment, subscribe, follow, hit the notification bells, all kinds of things you can do on these platforms nowadays. It's nuts. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, digital technology. It's insane. You can follow us on audio platforms, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, iTunes, of course. Love our audio listeners. Leave us a rating and review while you're over there, by the way. Would be a huge help. And if you've already done it, I really appreciate it. And thanks for listening and continuing to listen. Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, all these are social media places. Like, follow, comment. Tell us we said something funny or reply to something we said about something we said on the podcast. Anything helps. Everything helps. And we really appreciate it. Check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. And you can email us correspondence directly, one-to-one, you to us, and mail it offscriptfilmreview.com right into the show. Doesn't happen often enough, honestly. There was a time people wrote in every week, and now we're here. I'm kidding. It was never a time that happened, but it'd be cool if it did. So, you know, you could be the first, right? Start the trend. Be a trendsetter on Off-Script Film Review. And thanks for listening, as always, sincerely, for all the jokes about plugging stuff at the end. Like, really, really thanks for listening. And yeah, that's Off-Script Film Review, episode 310. From all of us at Off-Script, the home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.